Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome to F1 Explains, the official Formula One podcast, which takes your questions about our favorite sport and finds the experts to answer them. We love tackling your questions, and we've got a great one for this episode.
Hey guys, this is Danielle and Robbie, and we live in New Jersey.
We've been F1 fans for the past couple of years and love listening and learning more every week.
It's a sport that we are both super into, which is awesome to share together.
Our question for you is about tracks. We've noticed new tracks being added to the season, like Miami last year, and so whose job is it to create new track layouts, whether it's a full-time track or a street circuit?
Who decides where to put the straights and chicanes, and is there technology, given that it's Formula One, that goes into all of this? Thanks, and looking forward to learning more.
I've got a lot of things to say about this voice note. For a start, I love Danielle and Robbie's accents. They're from New Jersey. Danielle and Robbie in New Jersey, thank you. Secondly, how great are they at flip-flopping between us? They're almost too good and could replace us, Katie. That was brilliant.
I love that.
Might be one of the best voice notes we've ever had. Danielle and Robbie in New Jersey, excellent. Great questions. Hi also to Bassam from Lebanon, Dawn in New York, Jake in Wisconsin, Stacey in Colorado, Alberto from Mexico City, and Tommy from New Hampshire. Just some of our listeners who emailed to say, hey, F1 Explains, tell us about tracks. Well, we'll do exactly that.
Every year, F1 tours some of the greatest racetracks in the world, and every single one of them is different. Some have those really long, flat-out straights, and others have huge climbs or plunging drops like a roller coaster.
We've got everything you could possibly wish for on the Formula One calendar. Sweeping corner combinations taken at insane speed. Left, right, left at 180 miles per hour. Tight turns between barriers. Buildings on city streets. Each track is a unique test for the drivers and teams, pushing their courage, their cars, their muscles, and their minds to the limit, all in very different ways.
My gosh, did anybody just feel like we were about to start a race with that?
What can I say? I get excited by it all. I don't get out much.
Wow, that was impressive. Anyways, and they are all created by a team of designers. They're kind of like a mix between artists and engineers. They start with a sketch on a piece of paper, oftentimes, and turn it into a real-life racetrack. But as with everything in F1, the story of how that happens is fascinating. And that's what we love to dig into in the stories right here on this podcast.
Now, Danielle and Robbie mentioned the track in Miami in their beautifully crafted voice note. So we're going to explore circuit design with the very people who created that track. Just wait until you hear all the things designers have to think about. It's amazing.
It really is. But before we get to that, we should say a proper hello to everyone. So hello, I'm Katie.
Hi, I'm Christian Hugill. Welcome to F1 Explains. Me and Katie Osborne are here every week to answer your questions, and you can email us those questions at ywhy@f1.com. Katie, would you say, just a written email, or would you prefer a voice note?
Heck yeah, give me that voice note. Love a good voice note. Just use Danielle and Robbie as your example. That was just impressive. But honestly, I sent in a voice note recently into our podcast because of an absence that I had to explain myself. And I will tell you, it was very nerve-wracking even to be sending in a voice note to our own podcast. So if you do get a little anxious about it, no worries. Just send us an email. And we love those as well. We've gotten some great ones over our time together.
It still makes me laugh that you got nervous to send a voice note to the podcast you present.
I got sweaty. I literally started getting sweaty. It made me so anxious.
The reason you sent us a voice note is because you've had a baby, the wonderful Olivia Hope.
Yes.
How is the newborn baby, Katie? And most importantly, you said the other week she has a mullet. Does she still have a Valtteri Bottas-style mullet? Maybe does she now have a moustache like Valtteri? Is she turning into Valtteri Bottas?
We're keeping the facial hair down for now, but the mullet still stands. And it's just a little, it's still a little business in the front, party in the back, a little rat tail even. So real classic look. And I knew that we liked Valtteri Bottas. We knew that was a person that was very favorable for his personality on and off track. And I will say Olivia must have gotten that vibe. And she came out with a stellar Valtteri mullet. So still has it. A month in, still has it.
We'll get on with the actual podcast in a moment, I promise. But one more thing. You know, you're going to be able to play this podcast to Olivia one day and say you were sort of, as soon as you were born, mentioned on a podcast. Can I say on behalf of future Olivia, maybe come up with a better name for her hair than Rat's Tail? I feel like Mum could do something, I feel like something cuter for the baby girl. Do you know what I mean?
A unicorn horn coming from the
already
back.
Already better. Perfect. Prettier. She'll love that. She'll love that.
Moving on.
We're glad Olivia Hope is well. And one more piece of business before we get on with talking about racetracks. We're getting very close now to our first ever live show, F1 Explains Live at the US Grand Prix.
Christian, scale of 1 to 10. Excitement level?
104.
Yeah, I believe it. This man has more merch, F1 merch, than any person I've ever met. To be able to go to COTA, have our show live, and be able to talk to the fans and engage with our community, it is so stellar. And I think that is really ultimately, Christian, what I'm most excited about is the storytelling mixed with meeting the people who really make this show what it is. Literally, our show is a community-based show, and we get to tap into that in COTA.
Absolutely buzzing. And we've already had DMs and emails saying that you're going to be there and you're looking forward to meeting us. Thank you. We'll be on the amphitheater stage at, of course, the Circuit of the Americas on Friday the 20th of October at 11:30 a.m. That is before free practice one.
Yeah, that stage is near the F1 fan zone. So get to the circuit a little bit early, grab some breakfast, buy a cap, merch, whatever your little heart desires. Maybe an umbrella if it's warm. That's a good one. And then come watch us on the stage. It's going to be so much fun.
I allow myself one thing to buy, Katie, at every race. So I look forward to sharing with you what my one thing is.
Your piece of swag.
My piece of swag. If you've got a ticket for the Friday, you'll be able to come and see us for no extra cost. It will be us two, me and Katie Osborne, putting your F1 questions to our very special guests. And trust me, we've got some exciting guests lined up. So exciting that producer Chris doesn't want to say them yet in case we jinx it. But trust me, we're going to have exciting people with us on stage.
Yeah, so if you're going to be there, obviously DM us. Let us know via why@f1.com. Let us know you're going to be around. And then send us a question and we might be able to make you part of that show, especially if you're right there in the crowd. It's going to be so great. Again, F1 Explains Live, 11:30 a.m. on Friday, the 20th of October at Circuit of the Americas. All right.
Let's talk racetracks.
Created around the Hard Rock Stadium, home to the NFL's Miami Dolphins, the Miami International Autodrome has become a new party-style event on the F1 calendar. But today, we're going to find out just how demanding it is on a circuit as we prepare for 57 laps of the 5.4-kilometre, 3.3-mile flowing layout that crosses car parks and tennis courts, dives underneath highways, and provides a particularly tight and unforgiving section at two-thirds distance. Three DRS zones will hopefully allow for some overtaking, but we'll find out as we get into the race. And as a street circuit format, it's so easy to make a mistake and cloud a wall, as we've seen in practice already so far this weekend. It's a design that took several years to solidify, but it's now ready to prove what level of excitement it can deliver.
The Miami International Autodrome has given us plenty of excitement since its debut in 2022. Now, it is one of F1's newest racetracks, and it's the work of Apex Circuit Design.
So let's speak to its managing director, David Broom, and its engineering director, Andrew Wallace. Andrew, David, welcome to F1 Explains.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's very rare we get let out of our box to talk to people like you about the things that we enjoy doing on a daily basis.
Well, we're grateful to have you here. And I tell you what we should do, given that you are rarely allowed out of your box. Why don't you take the opportunity? And David, starting with yourself, can you guys give us a brief summary of what you guys do for a living?
Apex Circuit Design has been in business for over 14 years now. And we have developed race circuits across the globe, with our most recent effort being the Miami F1 Grand Prix that hosted its first race in 2022.
Yeah, so with Miami specifically, we were responsible for the motorsport precinct. If you think about the track itself, and then there's the runoff areas outside of that, the barrier systems that sit at the back that protect the drivers if they lose control, and then behind that you have a service road. And so when we sort of first heard about this opportunity, that specifically with Miami and the Hard Rock Stadium, there was an awesome opportunity to design a sort of world first in terms of a F1 racetrack around the Hard Rock Stadium, to leverage this awesome asset that was in the middle of the site.
And we're going to use Miami as our example in this episode, as our case study, if you like, with it being a sort of new track on the F1 calendar. So let's imagine we've decided Formula One's coming to Miami. We're going to do it around the Hard Rock Stadium. But at the moment, the Hard Rock Stadium is an NFL stadium. It's got its car parks. It's got its areas where the fans come and go. It's nowhere near a racing circuit. What on earth happens at the start?
So we have to look at how do we fit the requirements for a grade one circuit, which is the FIA grade that a Formula One circuit adheres to, onto, as you say, a large car park site, but with public roads to consider, and with this big stadium asset in the centre. So you've got the competitors, you've got the teams, and then we've got the spectators, we've got the support staff. And one of the first sort of jobs is to look at where is the access going to potentially be for this site, because we had a really challenging scenario where we have public roads that we needed to consider, needed to remain open during the event, and also how do we put the barrier systems in, fit a track within this space that has the least disruption. For an FIA grade one circuit, the minimum requirement is a 3.5 kilometer circuit, but we generally know we need to target roughly between 5 and 5.5 kilometers of circuit length. So we know we've got a ribbon that we need to fit within a space. We know we've got an awesome asset in the middle of the Hard Rock Stadium. Where do we fit in the straights into the circuit? Where do we put the corner sequences? So we produce a number of options early on. When we build this track, we need to put new circuit, not only within the car park, but on public roads. So there would be issues with resurfacing areas of public road. Would this be acceptable? What impact would that have? And then equally, when we start to lay out barrier systems on these public roads, how could we put them in for the event and then remove them each night and bring them back in the morning in the most efficient way possible?
The first ever Formula One Grand Prix to be held in the spectacular metropolitan area of Miami in Florida is all set to burst into action.
I mean, we had a really unique opportunity there. We had a unique opportunity to develop a racetrack that was bespoke, but there was also a temporary facility. And when we're talking about street circuits traditionally, you tend to be constrained by the roads in which you're given because they're in city environments. This time, we didn't have that constraint because we were able to build something that was tailored to the sport and that then utilized some of the external roads in order to bring the track length up to the desired track length that's suitable for Formula One. We really relished that opportunity, and we put a lot of effort into making sure that the circuit was not only good for the event, and provided somewhere that was spectacular, but also something that was exciting to drive, promoted overtaking, and provided the spectacle that people come to expect from Formula One.
What are some of those challenges when you kind of look at like the space when you're back home before you get to Miami and you're looking at a map of like this location and you're kind of like, okay, putting the pieces together? What are some of those challenges and maybe some of the skills that one might need to be able to put this thing together?
So on the face of it, I guess it looks like you've got a big stadium there, and then you've got a large amount of car parking space around it, albeit very beautified. But when you look a little closer, actually, there's a lot of constraints there because they host the Miami Open, so they have all the tennis court facilities that needed to remain untouched. They've got a big gondola through the site, which is awesome and crazy. And
I'm thinking of like a gondola man who sings down a river on a boat.
No, I was with you, Katie. I don't fully know what a gondola is.
Like a ski resort gondola. So it literally goes overhead.
Oh! I should know this because I've been on it, but I didn't know that was called a gondola. Right.
Exactly, right. So it goes from east to west across the site, and it was primarily built for the tennis to take people one end to the other.
Well, our producer Chris has just said it's like a cable car. That's what I'd have called it. Yeah.
Oh, right.
Who knew a cable car was called a gondola? Anyway, carry on.
So these are the smaller versions. Obviously, you can fit like four or five people in or something, and there's multiple ones that go up and down and around. So again, that's a constraint. It's an awesome opportunity as well, because we look again, how do we potentially bring the track close to that and leverage opportunity for people to view from that raised platform moving along whilst the track is hot below? So in that respect, we managed to find a way that we could bring the straight through between the tennis and the gondola, you know, weaving through the eye of a needle there, because we had just about enough space for the track and a bit of service road between the gondola columns and the tennis courts on the south side. You've also got a facility that has an event calendar that's absolutely packed, 365 days a year. There's stuff going on there. So we had to, you know, work with the local team to work out how do we piecemeal build this thing whilst had the least sort of effect on their day-to-day operations. So that was a real challenge there.
As interested as we are, Andrew, in access roads and gondolas, the stay with me. The sexiest part of this is always going to be designing a racetrack.
Oh, sure.
But I'm guessing by the sounds of it that you guys have got to think about, as you said, access roads, getting stuff in, the geography and the architecture of the site before you start going, right, let's make a cool race circuit. It's really simply, have I got that right?
100%, yeah. Because, you know, if we just, you know, designed a track in the space, didn't think about any of that and tried to fit the best track we could, inevitably that would have knock-on effects that would mean other things didn't work, you know, as well as they could, like the spectator areas, grandstanding, viewing opportunities, fan zones, respecting the constraints that I've mentioned. So you've got to think about all that early on. It's like a sort of puzzle that you've got to put together, thinking, okay, these are all the constraints I've got to consider. These are how we might want to get people in and out of the site. This is maybe where we want to put the start finish straight. So that's another kind of key thing. So early on, we knew the stadium is this unique opportunity. It has great viewing opportunities. It's got food and beverage in. It's got toilets. It's got all of the sort of administrative side of things that is really important on a racetrack, like toilets.
Really so important.
Really important. I don't underestimate that. But
I've got a very small bladder. It's arguably the most important for me.
Yeah. Sure. And how do we, you know, how do we kind of keep the start finish straight, which has an important adjacency to the pit lane, which then has an adjacency to the pit building? How do we get that close to the stadium and kind of leverage a unique opportunity there?
It's a little bit like, Katie, did you have this in the States when you were young? It's a bit like the game Roller Coaster Tycoon, which I used to play.
No, I missed that part of my childhood. I had no idea.
You could basically design a theme park. You could drop a roller coaster in, but it wouldn't let you physically drop it in until you'd got the access and the queue and the toilets. So it's like that. Brilliant. What happens now? Dafydd, take us through the first really exciting bit where you get to sit down and go, okay, let's make a racetrack.
Ultimately, there are a number of things that come together to make a good racetrack. Things like variable track widths, trying to encourage multiple racing lines around corners, putting in the straights is one key part of it, making sure that corner sequences are challenging. But also a key aspect of it is incorporating the elevation changes into the right areas of the circuit design in order to make sure that the track does feel like a roller coaster. Ultimately, if we are providing something that drivers enjoy driving, then we will have a track that is good to spectate.
Yeah, and I think interesting to talk about the different kinds of circuits and track layouts that you have from a Miami to something that could be more out in no man's land, if you will, and you're designing it from scratch in a big field. When you talk about the straights, you talk about these, it could be DRS zones, it could be all these, you know, chicanes or corners. Who is giving you, or is it just from your guys' point of view, the say to be like, okay, we need four corners, we need two chicanes, or is it you as kind of the big picture? We have this big idea of this one roller coaster, we're going to implement this idea, and somebody else is going to give us the feedback to say, no, we need more corners, we need more straights, and we need more roller coastery vibes.
I mean, sometimes the our clients or our customers do have a very good idea of what sort of track geometries and sort of track features that they want to incorporate. But very often they take a lead from what our professional opinion is. And we tend to use, I know it sounds boring, but we tend to use mathematics and mathematical simulations in order to understand what would be good for racing. We have a mathematical simulation that we use in-house that allows us to draw racing lines around any design that we produce so that we can understand the speeds of any particular vehicle that go around it. And that is our first port of call for understanding whether a corner sequence or a corner geometry or a track is good for the racing that we're working. The other tool at our disposal is that within in-house, we're able to develop driver-in-loop simulations or computer games, in effect, that allow us to very quickly take the design that we put together within our software and allow us to drive it in our simulator. And that provides you with a very good understanding of what the track is going to be like to drive.
That's fascinating to me. And I think my thought is how close are those simulator kind of cars to F1 cars are you running around a game-like track that you guys have designed?
I mean, the track is millimeter accurate because in that respect, we've designed it to surveys that we that are provided by surveyors as part of the initial generation of information for the project. If we wanted to, and we've done this in the past, we can actually supply the information that we produce in-house from our simulator to Formula One teams, and they run it on their platforms that then allow them to gain an understanding of what the track is going to be like before they even race it.
And also with Miami as well, with respect to F1 and Miami specifically, we put down a couple of options on paper and refined them a bit, did the simulation process, as Daf had mentioned, to see how it might drive and what sort of space and allocation we might need for runoff, and then shared that actually with Formula One vehicle performance team. So Formula One certainly more recently have liked to take a more active approach in the design and understanding of what kind of product they're going to receive and ultimately turn up to in terms of its opportunity for general racing, for overtaking, for things like pit stop strategy and even DRS zones quite early on. So that team were able to take our layout from CAD and run their own in-house simulations. And actually it became a little bit of an iterative design process where they suggested a bit of refinement and tweakery in some areas, and we worked together to ultimately refine and fix the layout that ended up getting built. So that was quite a unique and quite interesting way to work with those F1 team and something we hadn't really done before.
And I think it yielded good results, if I'm honest. The racing in Miami was good. And the overtaking scene during the race was amongst some of the highest on the calendar.
And going back to the start process, you mentioned that computer simulation, which me and Katie both find fascinating. Is that the very start, or does it get drawn out on pen and paper sort of thing? Or where does a racetrack start its life? Are you drawing it with a pen around, in this case, for example, the Hard Rock Stadium? Yeah. So it is starting life on a pen and paper, and then that's being loaded into a computer effectively.
Absolutely. It's the quickest way to band ideas around the team. We work extremely collaboratively as a team. In the offices, we're constantly sketching out ideas. It's the quickest way to get from brain to paper.
And actually, it's a great way to try and very quickly put down something that feels quite flowing and organic, is to sketch it out, you know, I find certainly with a pencil. Rather than get too sort of geometrical in the software environment, that early stage of sketching and trying to find something that feels nice is a good starting point, and we always go through that process.
So how much of it is artistry as opposed to true engineering in these early stages, like Christian's kind of pointing out?
There is a large element of creativity to it. I mean, you'd be surprised at just how artistic it can be. Ultimately, when you're looking at the racetrack and how it integrates with other developments that surround the track as part of an architectural side of the project, it becomes very artistic. In that respect, we've got a good team that can put that flair into the design. One of the criticisms of circuit designers in recent history is circuit designs have become computer generated. But that's where, as Andrew suggested, the sketching comes in to try and take out that geometric feel and create something that naturally looks flowing and naturally looks like it was going to be good to drive.
And Andrew, speaking more generally, what sort of corner gets the best racing. I mean, I personally, as a Formula One fan, like, I've always liked Silverstone, for example, where I notice a lot of the corners are quite wide, so cars can go two abreast. There's also then thrilling complexes at Silverstone, like Maggots and Becketts, which have a left-hander than a right-hander and all that sort of thing. And obviously, Silverstone's been around for so long. So when you guys are coming up with new circuits, are you taking inspiration from older circuits like Silverstone and other circuits that work best? Or how does that generally work? What sort of corners give us good racing?
Well, yes, we do take inspiration from historic corners that work well. And ultimately, as Daffod's already mentioned, we have the ability to simulate to an extent how a sort of race might unfold and how a track might drive. But using things like our driver and loop simulator, so when we get into the sort of computer-generated environment quite quickly, we can actually sit in a racing environment and take what we've sketched early on, sort of the organic initial sketch, and then quite quickly get that into something that you can see. Well, we know generally we want to create a circuit that has a variety of straights, some heavier braking zones, which traditionally do encourage the overtake, but also to have a variety of sort of mid-speed corner sequences. Turn 4 through turn 8 in Miami was quite a fast left-right-left sequence that really challenge the driver, and they give the spectator, you know, some thrilling fast action to watch on track. It's sort of a combination of, obviously, the overtaking is exciting and thrilling, but equally we want to challenge the driver with a speed trace. So if you look all the way around the circuit, you want a variety of different speeds through this circuit, some straights, some heavy braking zones, and some mid-corner sequences that challenge the driver, challenge the race engineer, because they, you know, for example, they know they can't just set up for the mid-speed corners. They have to think about the speeds on the straights and into the braking zones, and it challenges them to try and find that balance of setup.
When we're looking at a track, what we're trying to do is create a track that is challenging for the driver and challenging for the engineer that's setting up the car. And in that respect, it provides us with opportunities for mistakes to occur, either from the engineer's perspective or the driver's perspective.
So you're trying to catch the drivers out?
Absolutely, absolutely.
You fiends!
Absolutely.
You evil men!
Because if there is room for those mistakes to be made, then in that respect, there is opportunities for overtaking and good racing. And that is just as much as important for the engineer setting up the car as it is for the driver, as Andrew has already stated. But when it comes to corner sequencing that's good, or particular corners that are good for overtaking, there are some theories that we try and stick to. Ultimately, long straights that are followed by tighter corners provide the opportunity for vehicles to get within the slipstream of the vehicle in front, and then allow them to outbrake each other into corners that then creates the potential for overtake. There's another theory as well when it comes to the overtaking through corner sequences that are mid to high speed, is that if you allow the vehicles and the drivers enough traction beyond what they're currently driving through the corner, then it allows the cars to actually come offline, or that it gives the drivers more confidence to come offline through those corner sequences and attack a driver that's driving in front of them. So it's all about providing corner sequencing that means the cars aren't on their limit of adhesion as they go around the corner. Other areas that we can use, like elevation changes through corners, blind entry corners, blind exit corners, elevation changes mid-corner, allows, again, the vehicles or the drivers to be caught out such that mistakes occur on their laps, and allows other drivers that haven't made a mistake to take advantage.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Go guys, I'm going to give you some quick fire questions from our listeners, if that's okay. The one thing I love about, well, many things I love about our F1 Explains listeners, it could never be limited to just one, are that they will always ask questions I would never have thought of. And Bassam in Beirut in Lebanon is a brilliant example of this. What's the rationale behind choosing the length of the straights?
I mean, sometimes in a street circuit environment, it can be defined a little bit by what you have available working with the existing roads. I mean, typically, if you're going to have a straight in F1, it makes sense to have a certain sort of minimum length. Really, you want to get closer to a sort of the 1 kilometre mark, so you have a real opportunity for the vehicles, as Duffy had already mentioned, to get right up behind a vehicle in front and make that sort of overtaking opportunity, possibly up the inside or in the braking zone. So generally looking at often minimum lengths closest to 1 kilometre, and then also looking at, well, where can we potentially take the circuit, you know, in this street environment, or considering other straights, constraints that will sort of ultimately define its length. Generally, you don't want to go too much more than, you know, a bit over 1 kilometre, because then it just gets a bit dull. It's somewhere in that just below and just over 1 kilometre range is pretty good for...
And dull, especially if there's one car that's very good on some straights.
Yeah, exactly.
Then
I don't know what you could mean there, Katie. I'm not sure what you're referring to there.
No, I love good racing.
No, anyways. Sure. Dawn from New York says, let's give this one to you, David. Is there a minimum lap length or minimum number of corners?
No, there's not. Well, there is certainly a target lap length that we're looking for. The length of track circuit that we tend to focus on for Formula One tracks is somewhere between 5 and 5.5 kilometres.
And the final quickfire one, back to you, Andrew, is from Lauren in Bexley in the UK. And Lauren says, how do you decide whether a track runs clockwise or anti-clockwise, and what difference does it make?
To be honest, there's no hard and fast rule with that, really. It depends on the location a little bit, and sort of, again, as I mentioned, the sort of site you've got to work with and where you might want to put your sort of start, finish straight and your pit building. Generally, you know, we do design clockwise or we do design anti-clockwise circuits. We don't really favour any particular one in our circuit design.
Out of curiosity with that, one of the things I think about with anti-clockwise or counterclockwise here stateside is the idea of you walk into a bedroom and you feel like the feng shui is off, right? Like that idea of like, the bed should be over there, or like a hotel room, right? Where all of a sudden you're like, oh, the last hotel room, it felt normal. This one feels a little off. Is there any thought within counterclockwise or anticlockwise track design that some drivers or feedback is that it feels a little wonky for them to drive that style of track?
Well, drivers always have their preferences, right?
And they love a moan. Racing drivers love a moan. So ignore what they think. They'll moan anyway.
And it's up to us to provide a challenge at the end of the day. So if we're putting the drivers out of their comfort zone, it does help along the way.
I was going to say, I feel like a feng shui of driving counterclockwise would feel a little, you could probably feel it as a driver. Okay, Stacey from Colorado asks, can you explain quickly how the surface of an F1 track is different to the surface of an everyday road? I find these questions really interesting because I do think as non-racing drivers, it would be really great to better understand, you know, what those feelings, if there is a feeling difference.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the world of asphalt design is pretty complex. It's a bit of a dark art, and there's loads of factors that kind of come together to make the race circuit asphalt different from a normal road. But generally, it's a lot smoother. So the tolerances set by the FIA are very, very tight on the smoothness of the circuit along its length. So as you're driving along, we don't want to be creating a circuit that's really bumpy. And then you imagine all the stresses that the asphalt goes under during a sort of Grand Prix weekend when there's heavy braking, there's high lateral loads applied to it. It's getting high sideways loads and high shear loads applied to it. So the mix design and the way that it's constructed need to be able to deal with these sort of increased stresses that you don't usually see from a normal road car that are very present in certainly in the F1 cars.
And another thing to add to that is the texture, the surface texture of the track. Ultimately, what you're trying to look for is a sweet spot in terms of texture of the track that allows for a degradation of the tires that then allows for the strategy to evolve as to when tires should be changed during the race.
Well, I think another very interesting thing is pole position to maybe that first corner. Who decides that distance between pole position and maybe that first corner, that first turn, that first big action spot?
Well, the FIA do sort of have a minimum guidance for the distance between pole position and turn one, and that's about 250 meters. So we're sort of looking to target that as a minimum, but really you probably appreciate the bigger distance you have to turn one, there's greater opportunity when, you know, the lights go out and the cars engage and some people react quicker, some people have a better start than others. There's more opportunity for them to gain on that sort of better start and potentially make an overtaking opportunity before turn one. So really we try and look at maximizing that where possible, getting sort of closer to 600 meters or even more than that if possible, just so you've got a really long run in and an opportunity for some real action into the first turn.
This is more of a personal question as it relates to corner naming corners. Okay, so when you guys are doing the track design and you're penciling on a piece of paper and you're like, oh, this is going to be like bagels and this next one's going to be cream cheese. I'm just spitballing. I don't know what you guys think of when you're doing track designs, right?
Cream cheese, love it.
Yeah, clearly that's what I've been eating recently with post-baby. Yeah. Anyways, the idea of you guys coming up with corner names and then when, of course, you take it to somebody within Formula One, somebody else has a much better idea for the corner names or straights or whatnot. Do you become partial to maybe what you guys have put on the map as like your, like, oh, I'd really love it if it was called Lion's Den or whatever.
And
all of a sudden you're like, man, I'm kind of bummed because I'm partial now to what I've come up with it and someone else has a quote unquote better name for it and I'm the track designer. Has that ever happened to either of you?
I mean, it has happened to me. I've come up with a couple of names, usually in jest, for corners, and the client obviously hasn't taken those on board. But one
bagels and cream cheese doesn't flare with it as much. Understood.
It depends entirely on the culture that you're working in.
Sure.
So we recently did a project in Australia where we did a sort of a modern replica of Eau Rouge, and we called it Eau Rouge. just in relation to the kangaroos that were hopping across the site. We have had opportunities, just depends on the client's appetite.
Is it in any way possible if you guys could bring in Katie Osborne for the next time you're doing this? Because I'd
become partial, I think, in my designs.
Desperate to hear Alex Jakes commentating on Formula One going, Hamilton's made a fantastic move into bagels and cream cheese, but is he going to be able to defend it down into Lion's Den? You know, I would just love that.
I've always thought it would be fun to name nail polish and name Crayola crayons. Like I have a whole stack of creative names. Anyways, I just was curious if that was something when you're in the design, it becomes your baby a little bit. And then all of a sudden someone else's hands get on it and it kind of changes what you initially kind of envisioned and how that could from a creative standpoint. Anyways,
guys, very quickly before we let you go, because we've taken up enough of your time. I want to ask you a cheat question at the end, starting with you, Dafydd. Forget company alliances. We're all friends here in Formula One. And it might not even be a track still in Formula One, by the way, but is there a particular motor racing circuit across the world that, as proper professionals in this game, that you go, love it, they've nailed that, that's fantastic? Ideally one that isn't one of yours, because we know you've done, and by the way, you have done a genuinely stunning job with Miami. Anyone who's lucky enough to have been like I will tell you, it is a wonderful facility. It is fantastic. So you've had your praise, forget that, pick something else. What are the circuits that have done a really good job?
Certainly Spa. It's a beautiful track. It's long, which is unusual for Formula One, but the elevation just blows you away every time you see it, over 100 meters across that track. In terms of racing, it always delivers as well with the fact that, again, it goes back to these statements that Andrew and I made earlier, where you're trying to create something that is challenging for the driver, but also is challenging for the engineer. And I think Spa is probably one of the most challenging tracks for engineers to set up for, purely because of that elevation change and the way that they have to make sure that the car is good for various geometries and corner speeds.
Dafydd's picked Spa. Andrew, you've now got to pick something else as well. We're quite harsh on this podcast. You can't pick Spa as well. So even if that was your first, what's your second?
Interlagos is a great circuit.
Yes, excellent shout.
It's a circuit that doesn't, for example, have lots of the traditional long straight and heavy braking zones. But it gets great overtaking, gets great racing. The rain always plays a big part, or often plays a big part there. But the natural elevation combined with the multiple racing lines that you can take through quite a few corner sequences always gives awesome opportunities for overtaking, lots of drama. Yeah, that'd probably be up there for me. But then equally got things like Silverstone, an awesome race circuit. It's almost completely flat, so you don't always need the elevation change to get the great races. Probably those two, bit of a cheat. So I said two, but yeah.
No, that's what you can say two. The cheat would have been just saying, well, Miami was perfect, and frankly, all the others pale into insignificance. So no, you did fantastically well. And I mean what I said, guys, as well. I would actively encourage any of our listeners, particularly if they're stateside, to nip over to Miami, because it is just such a wonderful facility to go and watch motor racing. That's the thing I least expected when I got there, just to be how it fits so well around the stadium and what a great place it is to go and watch an F1 race. There isn't really another setup like that in the world. So yeah, it's a brilliant facility.
Yeah, and I think it showed on television and whatnot too. I think it was light, it's bright, it's colorful, it has an impact. I really think, you know, of course, the classic circuits and tracks, you can't argue that Spa isn't just beautiful the way that the layout is and the elevation and every corner is a wee bit different. But I can also agree with that too, Christian. Yeah. Your sentiments is it just appeared energetic is kind of the word that I would use to describe the Miami layout, the track, and the energy associated with it. But gentlemen, thank you. Thank you for your time and your insights. So thank you, David. Thank you, Andrew, both of you, for your time and your efforts here.
Well, we're happy to join you at any time you like.
Yeah, thanks very much. It's great to be on.
Christian, can you ever imagine designing a racetrack? Would it look like an actual F1 track? What they do is insane and impressive and wild all at the same time.
I can't imagine it, but do you know what I'd do if I were to design a racetrack? And by the way, thank you to both the guys. They were fantastic. And there was so much more that went into it than I ever imagined. But you know, when we launched this podcast, Katie, and obviously the podcast is all about answering questions. So the lovely people at F1 designed for our logo a racetrack that looks like a question mark.
And that was impressive too.
Very impressive. And lots of people DM'd me being like, that would make a great track. So I think if ever I were to design a racetrack, I'd create the F1 Explains Grand Prix.
Oh, does that mean,
yeah.
I wonder if our name's in the title like that, if we need to support it financially, that's another conversation. But our little question mark would be a great little couple of straights here and there, a good old-fashioned turn.
I've sorted that. Producer Chris would pay for it.
Yeah, okay.
It's fine.
Yeah. Okay.
He could just pay for it all.
He's silent right now, but he's nodding his head. And I think he must agree that that would be something he could do. Anyways, thank you, both of them. I am blown away at all that goes into the logistics and making sure a track is safe and a track is what it is for all of us fans to really enjoy. It's really impressive.
I tell you what I didn't know as well. I knew that F1 teams use simulators. We've spoken about on this podcast. We've done a whole episode on it.
Yeah, that
was
cool.
Yeah, but I didn't realize that circuit makers use simulators too. Very cool.
Another thing I would love to see is if they kept their napkins and paper in a top drawer somewhere. If we could get those in like a photo album and then flip through the photo album of all of these sketches that these designers and engineers have designed over the course of their career, it would be cool to see like a flip book of designs.
Could put it in the F1 Museum in Madrid.
There you go. Boom.
There you go.
Good idea. Before we go, Christian, this has been a riveting show.
Anyway.
We have some emails from our community. And Olivia in Wisconsin, I'm really glad to be able to say this one out loud because I love her spelling. It is not quite like our Olivia Hope, but Olivia in Wisconsin, that is one cool way to spell your name.
So hang on. So Olivia Hope, baby Olivia is with an I, and Olivia in Wisconsin is Olivya.
I've never seen it done that way. Yeah, that is very, very special. Olivia in Wisconsin is a brand new F1 fan. She says she's been watching for a couple of weeks. She is curious about why F1 teams have reserve drivers. Olivia, we can offer this. Go back and listen to our episode on simulators because we did speak to a reserve driver and he explains what it is that they do.
Well, we've just mentioned the simulators episode. Excellent. Mm-hmm. Hello to Jim in Minnesota. He wants to know about the difference between a slipstream, which helps drivers overtake, and dirty air, which makes it harder. We've also already touched on that. Scroll back on this feed to our episode on DRS. That tells you everything you need to know, Jim.
Also, quick hellos to Michael in Brazil, Mark in Park City, Utah, Greg from New Hampshire, Martin in Denmark, Leo in Australia, and Kevin from Ireland, who all sent us nice messages about the show and have also given us questions that we'll use in future episodes.
And the good news is we've had so many questions sent to us recently, so thank you to that. If you haven't heard your name read or your question asked yet on this show, we will be doing a quickfire episode soon, and hopefully we'll get to some of those as well.
And also into next season as well. We're already banking them for 2024, and we already want more. So why@f1.com is the address for those questions or comments about the show. And it's also how to tell us that you'll be in Austin for our live show at the Circuit of the Americas. We want to make you part of the show. Tell us if you're going to be there. If you have a race ticket, come and see us Friday the 20th of October, 11:30 a.m. We might be able to make you part of the show. Don't forget to leave us a rating or a review. Hit the follow button. We appreciate it, and we appreciate you listening to F1 Explains. For me and Katie, bye for now.
Bye.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.